This podcast is brought to you with limited interruption by Rudy Luther Toyota. Whether looking for an exciting brand new Toyota, a certified pre-owned vehicle, or getting quality routine maintenance and service for your vehicle, Rudy Luther Toyota is the place to go. Rudy Luther Toyota, the southeast corner of 394 and 169 in Golden Valley. Broadcasting live on AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota, and in the evenings on WCPT 820, Chicago's Progressive Talk. It's the Matt McNeil Show for your Thursday. Good to be with you today. Matt and Brett here today. Coming up, busy 4 o'clock hour locally here in the Twin Cities. Rick Hansen, the representative, is going to join us to talk about the natural resources bill. And Maggie Ferris, comedian, is going to join us as well. Talk about some shows coming up this weekend. Brett, how are we today?
I'm doing good here. How about you?
I'm doing fine. It's nice to see the tulip. I saw my first tulip coming up now. Get the thing. Have you seen how much it's greened up here since we got that rain that came through?
I have, but yeah, it's a little cool for everything to be greening up. But I guess we were warm.
I'm not going to complain, man. Yeah. I'm not going to complain. It's so nice to see the changing seasons. Because let's face it, the upper Midwest, whether you're Chicago or Minneapolis, St. Paul, early spring sucks. I mean, everything's wet and dirty and sandy and salty.
That describes March and early April in the Midwest. Yes.
Yes, it does. So I'm glad to see it.
The people too sometimes.
Well, yeah. It's just that's what like, keep mind your P's and Q's there, buddy. 952-946-6205. All right, I've come to a realization, Brett, that the Republican in the U.S. House, especially the far right Freedom Caucus, they need some marketing help. All right, they need marketing help. The House Freedom Caucus members are signing up to take shifts and guard the House floor in order to prevent resolutions they consider unsavory from slipping through that could curb their power. This is reported on X, Twitter. This is the quote that they have put out there. This floor action response team aims to guard against voice votes or unanimous consent votes where action can be stealthily taken against them and their members. Wait a second here. The floor action response team. You mean FART.
Did they really put that out there as the... Yes, it's the name. That's an incredible name.
The far-right House Republican group Thursday appeared to be plotting a defensive tactic against moderate counterparts, assembled an effort, their floor action response team. It's a political...
No one thought this through, did they? No, they didn't. Came up with a worst acronym for their name.
Oh, can we? Could we come up with this? All right, give me a second here. It's been a while since I've done comedy improv here, but The Committee for Unilateral Necessities for never mind. The Conference of Official Construction, and I need something for a K. What?
They had to go with team. They couldn't go with like group or something as that last as the last word. Then it would be
no. This is the right team. This is the right call for this. The House for. The floor action response team. How are you guys this bad at this? How are you this bad at this? The floor action retirement team aims to guard against voice votes once again. This is from the political people. Received word of anonymous sources, as did Punchbowl News as well. Freedom Caucus members plotting defensive tactic to man the House floor today to avoid any meddling by moderates. The caucus has concerns that Representative Thomas Massie, not a caucus member, but a staunch conservative, and Chip Roy, the caucus policy chair, could find themselves knocked from the powerful House Rules Committee by moderates. So technically, this would be possible to file unanimous consent on that. One member told me if moderates try to kick off those members, it'd be an act of war. Tempers were ready. It's hard to be a Democrat. So what do you want to do? Do you want to save Speaker Johnson, or do you want to just watch that far freedom right caucus just see the veins in their forehead, in their neck? That, you know, I mean, you know, Marjorie Taylor Greene might actually ascend to the Hulk form. I mean, because We don't know what steroids that woman's been using, but I can tell you what, that ain't natural. Hey, thanks, Jose Canseco. But, you know, dear Lord, what do you do? What would you do if you had your choice? Do you save Johnson and get the right mad, or do you watch the Republican Party devolve into basically Planet of the Apes without the dignity?
As fun as that would be, I think we still need to support Ukraine.
Well, and I like Stein's point yesterday. Did you hear that? Stein said, it's like, I don't think the Democrats are going to save them, but all of a sudden there's going to be important phone calls for how many do you need off the floor? 20 Democrats. 20 Democrats got to go take a phone call right now, so we're just not going to be here to vote. We'll give them the numbers, the margins to stay afloat there. Oh, God. It is. It's. They are really, really bad at this. Tempers were running high in the Rules Committee Thursday when lawmakers fumed over delays in funding aid to war-beleaguered Ukraine in a hearing on three foreign aid packages. Representative Rosa DeLauro, Connecticut, was jumping out of her seat to condemn far-right Republicans who complained about border security after killing an immigration bill, she said, at Trump's behest. For months and months, we've been diddling around. If that's the way you want to be remembered in history, it's certainly not the way I want to be remembered. But that's, you remember, this is, they don't... All they care about is making the left mad. Effective leadership? Come on, man. These guys aren't about effective leadership. They're only about, if you talk to the standard Trump voter, I'm not talking about moderate, because I know enough moderate Republicans, a guy named Michael Broadcorp up here on the Twin Cities, very good example of this. Still Republican, still disagree with him on a lot of things, but civil and understandable. He wants to make the country better in his what he feels are the better policies. I disagree with those policies. We can have a discussion. That's easy. I mean, that's it. As a matter of fact, I actually kind of enjoy talking to the guy about that, because even though we don't agree on things, we have a civil discussion. That's not what these guys are. These guys, their main goal is chaos. They want to see liberal tears. That's the only thing they want. And they are the people who will gladly applaud the Titanic sinking as long as they are 5 feet higher up on the deck than their enemies. And that's who they are. I will suffer. I will have bad health care, no quality schools. My quality of life will be bad. Have half my family on meth. I don't care. As long as I see a Democratic tear before everything just goes dark, I'll be happy. Oh. It's been an interesting day. I got to get to a lot of things. I do want to get into rural health care, because that's a huge problem, courtesy of the Republican Party. I want to talk about what's going on in the New York case here, the New York trial. A young oncology nurse told the court Thursday morning that after sleeping on it, she did not want to serve on Trump's jury. The judge said the woman was brought into the courtroom and explained to friends and family had warned her that her personal identifying information had been made public. I'll come back to that. I definitely have concerns now, she said to the court. I don't believe at this point I can be fair and unbiased about not letting outside influences affect my decision making. So basically what she's saying is she's gotten threats from the outside world. And so henceforth, she is, you know, and understandably very concerned. This on top. Now, once again, they had seven jurors. A second juror was dismissed. This after lying on some forms, their form about things, and you know it's one of those things where, you know, he was upset because he didn't want to say, he didn't want to be kicked off the jury, but there was obviously, you know, some concern about that. Merchant called in a third group of a nearly 100 potential jurors, swearing them even before releasing them for the day. We're not done with the second batch of potential jurors, but the attorneys need time to assess the prospects just who, you know, for those who just completed. It's obviously, it's, we are in a real disgusting part. I think what you have seen, you're seeing right now, is that the Republican Party and Trump and these Trump loyalists know he's going to lose this case if this case goes forward. And so if it's on the facts, they will lose. So now they're just outright with jury tampering. And that's and this is kind of scary. An Alabama law school professor, Joyce Weiss Vance, referred to Donald Trump's jury intimidation as outright mafia-like. Wednesday night, Trump began posting online about jurors just hours before one told the judge she was concerned her identity be compromised. The information that was publicly reported prompted her family to reach out and ask if she was on the jury. So her family was able to identify her fairly quickly by just what was put out there. Having her identity compromised could endanger her life, given the examples from the past in MAGA, because that's who these people are, is that they're just so, they are so determined to make their life, their version of the world real, that they'll kill somebody. And then it was only after that, oh, I shouldn't have murdered that person. Now you gotta feel sorry for me. I mean, isn't that half the guys from the January 6th? You know, all of a sudden, it's like they're all bragging about it. All of a sudden, when the police go, oh, wait a second here. I tried to overthrow the government here. What? Holy cow. I guess I'm a horrible human being. I need to have your mercy. Nope. Going back to Vance, I can't help but contemplate what jurors are concerned about being publicly identified in a case involving the former president. Typically, you'd only see that happen in a case involving violent organized crime. Yep. Another juror in the case was arrested for pulling down posters in the 1990s and said Thursday he'd failed to disclose the information when selected. He also expressed concern about how much was revealed about the jurors seated and was dismissed. Vance briefly appeared on MSNBC to echo her online sentiments, telling Andrea Mitchell that only parallel she has to something like this is violent organized crime cases. The potential of juror being questioned about his activities in the 1990s isn't outside the norm, she explained. What's so unusual here is a concern for the other juror who walked in after being selected and said, I don't think I can be impartial because of all the outside influences that are being exerted against me. Former U.S. Attorney Andrew Weissman helped prosecute organized crime cases in New York. Similarly had questions about the protection of the jurors, a Manhattan jury selection concern, whether it's been or will continue to be the strategic dissemination of information by the Trump team and about jurors who are seen problematic for them in order to scare them off from jury service, which is, I think that's exactly what's happening. Trust me, when this jury is seated, Trump is going to do everything in his power to find out who exactly is on this jury. And unleash his mob on them. And yeah, I have no doubt in my mind that the goal is to get someone's house torched, get someone shot at, something like this, and basically, you know, have them hopefully throw their arms in the air and say, I guess we can't prosecute this now, because that's the whole goal. He wants this pushed back until after the election. So, yep, that's what's going on. I'm going to point out one particularly nasty fart here in a second. This is the Matt McNeil Show in just a moment. You know, I'm always looking. It is the Matt McNeil Show on a Thursday. Apparently, Trump is freezing in the courtroom. He's absolutely freezing.
He's not sleeping.
Yeah, well, did they turn down the air conditioning so that basically he wouldn't sleep? That's my thought exactly. There is one particularly ugly disgrace of a human being that I think is responsible for this one juror having to flee the case. Juror number two in the Trump hush money trial was dismissed Thursday after she raised concerns about her identity being compromised. Washington Post reporter Erin Blake immediately drew a line between her dismissal and the Tuesday night segment on Fox News in which host and basically world's ugliest virgin, Jesse Waters, broadcast some personal details about the jurors whose names were not being identified publicly. Fox News host Jesse Waters. God, I can't stand that guy. I can't stand that guy because he is like a human version of a date rape drug. I mean, he's like a polo shirt with wine stains come to life. Matt, tell me what you really feel. All right. Don't like the guy. He basically went broadcast biographical details about juror number two, her neighborhood, occupation, education, marital and family status, what industry her fiance works for. He concluded by saying, I'm not sure about juror number two. I know it's number two. The juror that Waters said he wasn't so sure about was the same one who was dismissed on Thursday. Waters followed up the segment on Wednesday by declaring, without providing any evidence, that undercover liberal activists were lying about their feelings about former President Trump to get the jury and to convict him no matter the evidence. Mind this, this is after Republicans said, hey, rightos, sneak onto the jury. Lie all you can. Remember that jury tampering guy? Yeah. Just a... Yeah, it is good. Now, apparently, he's basically come on out. By the way, Trump today as well pulled out his phone during the trial. Which you're not supposed to do. You can't have a phone. His own lawyer had to say, put that away. Put it away. Put it away.
But I just wanted to go and talk about how I want people to murder the judge.
I mean, the juror that was dismissed described him as yellow and kind of sad. Yellow.
Not orange. That's a different description. Well, I can see he's a little yellow.
It's spring, you know. You want to get the hues in there. I mean, to match the you know, tiptoe for the tulips, my friend. You know, when he had that brown look, that's more of an autumn. You know, you're looking pumpkins, you know, leaf changing, you know. And, you know, he needs to put on the spring color. I love the point that, who's the guy on MSNBC in the evenings there? He made points. He does every part of his face but his ears. So his ears are a different color than the rest of them. Oh, God. Thank you. Thank you for your service. I did want to bring up something, though, that is a point because it is pretty obvious to me that the Republicans out there, the media is failing us in once again describing what is actually happening. Let's say at an official presidential event, you had Biden fall asleep twice. Trump fell asleep so hard the first time, the sketch artist was able to sketch him asleep at the table. And the thing which is funny is that this isn't that hard to stay awake during your court, your trial. But yet all these people don't understand how boring it is. I mean, it's not like you have napping, you know, defendants constantly. It doesn't bode well for them. But let's just go back to the larger picture here. The media's ability to shape public opinion is well documented, and by the end of the second day of the first criminal trial in history of the former U.S. president's critics were slamming the content, framing, and focus of mainstream media organizations. The biggest concerns, refusing to cover the former president's apparent inability to stay awake in court. Too much identifying information of potential and chosen jurors, and even subtle descriptions that can be used to feed into a false perception the trial is unfair, or as the ex-president likes to say, a scam. Now, this is on top of last week, one of the Silicon Valley guys talked about a meeting. He was called into a meeting with Trump when he was president to talk about the threat of China. And it was an hour long. It was scheduled to be an hour long meeting. Trump spent 45 minutes talking about Stormy Daniels and trashing her. This is to all the business leaders of the world. He spent out of an hour. He spent 45 minutes talking about, I don't think she's hot. Do you think I'd pay money to go sleep with her? I don't think I would. 45 minutes of this, to which he said, the Silicon Valley guys just sort of said they sat there and kind of nodded and yeah. And finally, at the very end, got into China, which he clearly was not even interested in the point of the meeting. That's bad enough as it is. I mean, pre-Trump, that would have ended your career. That would have ended your political career. No one would even think about voting for you in 2014 if that was the kind of behavior you were doing. But here he is. He's falling asleep. Reliable sources on CNN blasted mainstream media outlets that strangely show little interest in reporting on Donald Trump's courtroom naps. Imagine for a moment if President Joe Biden were caught openly sleeping at an important hearing, Darcy posed. Trump is caught nodding off repeatedly several times over the first 2 days of the trial. Then imagine if it was to occur at another important hearing the next day. Not only would right-wing news medias like Fox run wild with coverage questioning his fitness for office, mainstream news organizations would no doubt also treat the snooze fest as a serious news story. But for some unknown reason, Donald Trump falling asleep in his historic criminal trial in New York twice has been met with rather muted response. Noting it's important, Darcy asked, that how much of the press fallen asleep, has press fallen asleep at the wheel. ABC News and NBC News didn't even bother mentioning it on their evening newscast. Many new outlets haven't even filed straight stories on it. And to be frank, if not for the New York Times' Maggie Haberman reporting on the matter on Tuesday, the court sketch artist sketching them mid-doze. It's unclear whether the public, which is relying on news organizations to be its eyes and ears in the courtroom, game cameras are barred, would know about it at all. It's all the more bizarre given that Trump has made attacking Sleepy Joe, the exact quote, Sleepy Joe, a central tenet of his campaign, framing the president as lacking the stamina to serve the nation's highest office, which is to say the fact that Trump is one apparently unable to stay awake. I mean, if not for the late night talk show hosts ripping him to shreds for this, which they have, this would have been buried. And once again, go look at the news coverage. I mean, there was one story I saw Biden today. Was it the New York Times put it out? It's like Biden just pandering to certain groups, talking about Native Americans and steel workers and students, and acting as if, how dare he do this? Trump is falling asleep in his own trial. And yet we do not have nearly as many people as we should talking about the fact that this guy clearly cannot be the president of the United States. Joe Biden's out there sprinting across the country, giving us inspiration. Donald Trump needs a nap. It's the Matt McNeil Show. Broadcasting in the evening on WCPT 820, Chicago's Progressive Talk, and in the afternoons on AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show. 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. I want to preface this next discussion I want to have here with 2 points. The first is, I have a friend who lives out in rural Minnesota. And he's actually telling me, you know, he's doing well with business. He works in landscaping and gardening and stuff. And he says, well, I've got, you know, some pretty big contracts, of lawn care for some of the wealthiest farmers in the area where he lives. And these are the big farmers that basically bought up other people. And I said, wow, you know, so and you go past their house. Have you ever driven out in rural America? You drive past a farm where it's got the front gate and it's manicured and there's an idyllic farmhouse and then the idyllic barn out there. It's perfect for posing for photo ops when it's time for your Christmas card. But the reality is it's not practical. They run, it's a corporation basically that's, you know, disguised as a farm. He says, oh, yeah, they're basically, the people are hardly there. And this is his exact words. He said, the people that own these places are hardly there, but they want to make it look like there's people there all the time. So not only does he do yard work and, you know, trim and stuff like this, but he also makes sure the lights are working and all these things. These are extras that he gets paid for to make it look like, and, you know, make it look like if there's a storm, their leaves, they're clearing off the driveway, stuff like that. So it looks like there's people living there all the time. He says, oh, these people haven't lived here for years. Really? Oh, yeah. They left a long time ago because the quality of life in rural communities had been deteriorating. And so they move, they spend, even though they still own the place, and they're out there, especially, you know, and they do come on out for planting season and harvest time. But for the most part, they're not there. They live in one of the major cities, whether it's Minneapolis, St. Paul, or over to Sioux Falls, or they might go up to Fargo, but that's where they live. So their kids can get a good, and their kids go to private school out there. And so they're not, the kids are hardly ever there on the farm anymore. It's not the idyllic world where you, where you think about Ma and Pa and the kids on the farm, and there's biscuits and a pie, bacon, while you know, Grandpa's working on the tractor sort of thing. No, that doesn't exist anymore. And he even said he knows a lot about technology, and he was the first guy that suggested to me, probably within 30, 40 years, when farms really become automated, that the quote-unquote farmers that own the farms won't even live on the farmland, that they'll be in high-rise apartment buildings in Chicago and in Minneapolis and run things, everything automated, and they'll have a few farm hands on the ground to take care of breakdowns and stuff like this, but they're going to sit there and talk about, I'm a farmer, and they're going to live on the 37th floor of a skyrise apartment building. So yeah, that's just kind of the way things are. I bring that point up because, and I'll say, I'm going to get to this because the finances is the main goal. And that this plays a big role in this. I have a connection, a personal connection to rural healthcare. My great-grandfather, my grandmother on my father's side's dad, was a guy named Charles Bielenant. And Charles Bielenant, he initially went to northern Minnesota. He graduated medical school here, I think, in the state of Minnesota, if I'm not mistaken. And he went out, and this is back in the day when the lumber companies were the only people in northern Minnesota. And he got a contract to be the doctor for the lumber companies, which was really cool. He had a self-driving train car that was his medical, you know, unit that had, you know, an examination room. And if he had to do an operation or something, he could do it in there, all the stuff that he needed. And he would drive it out these train tracks that went out to the lumber camps, and he'd go visit every camp and you would see them. And he could basically go up and down the tracks when he needed to. And yeah, kind of a slick deal. When they lumbered out northern Minnesota, he then became kind of transferred from the lumber industry to the mining industry, became the official doctor for some of the mines, and eventually kind of as healthcare evolved out there, stopped being so much of a company position, it became more of a community position. And if you're from Virginia, Minnesota, you know if you've been there for a long time, there was the Charles Bielenant Clinic up there for many years. And he was the guy that started the hospital in Virginia, which is a regional area. So it's something for me, there's a tremendous amount of pride I have in family members that went out into the rural parts of this country and brought medicine and hope for the people that were out there. Because if not for that, I mean, if you don't know where Virginia, Minnesota is, it's up on the Iron Range. Duluth, maybe Hibbing, but probably Duluth would have been your nearest medical doctor. And back in those days, that was probably a 2.5 to 3 hour drive, if the roads even existed. Probably had to jump on a train. Hope, you know, put pressure on that until you get there. Be careful with that. The true legacy. Here's my main point. Those are the two things I wanted to get out, because this does matter to me. The true legacy of Republicans controlling rural America is that we have watched rural health care get annihilated by Republican policies. And it might not be direct, but I will say this. They're sitting and watching all their hospitals close or pull back service. And they're out there constantly worrying about, you know, if you're living in these towns, if my pregnant wife goes into labor, I can't, you know, unless it's an emergency situation, I have to drive. Hopefully she, you know, doesn't start giving birth as I have the 45 minute to an hour drive to the nearest hospital that has a maternity ward in it. You have a serious problem. I mean, the days of you having a specialized clinic locally are pretty much gone. You might have a small cancer treatment facility, but for the most part, most people are having to go to the larger cities now. You don't have the medical establishment like you used to have in rural America. I brought this up because there's another hospital here that basically is getting rid of its inpatient facility, that basically it's only going to become an emergency care facility. They're not going to even have you know, an ability that if you need to stay for a few days, if you have an emergency, they're going to have to airlift you or drive you by ambulance to a larger metro area. By the way, a little pricey on your medical insurance if you've got that. And the reality is this is an absolute mess. And then people have been, I posted this story this morning, and people have been sending me stories from across the upper Midwest of the same thing. This is one of them that came across. Eau Claire and Chippewa Falls hospitals are closed. State Wisconsin legislature had money to keep them open, but the Republicans refused to release the money. This is Eau Claire, Wisconsin. This is not necessary. We are starting to see this now hit the larger communities. Forget about the town of 4,000 to 5,000 people that might have at one point had a medical facility in it. Now you're seeing the towns of up to 100,000 people in them losing medical facilities, closing down specialty clinics, saying, if you want that, then you need to go to the city. And this is one of the reasons why the wealthy people in these rural communities, for the most part, they don't live in the rural communities. Because they don't have, I mean, they have the money to where they can live somewhere where there's actually competent and complete medical care. Now, why is this? Why is this happening? There's a lot of reasons why. All of them point to the Republicans. First, let's talk about something I have talked about multiple times. The absolutely annihilated economic structure of rural America, where back in, say, 1980, you would have in a small town, small metro area, 1,000 farmers making the equivalent of probably $70,000-$75,000 a year, depending on the crop prices, where they came in, what their margins were. But you had a lot of farmers that were making money. Today, you don't have 1,000 of those guys. What you've got is you've got probably 10 farmers who are owning all the other farms. You work what used to be your family's land, which is now their land, and you work that, and you get a paycheck. You might get some margins there, but the economic base that used to exist in rural America just doesn't exist there anymore. And those wealthy farmers, it's not like they're buying 20 jugs of milk when they go to the grocery store, even if they are living in the community where they basically own all the land. They're not buying 20 gallons of milk. No, they've run off the farmers. The farmers aren't even there anymore. And in small town after small town after small town, go out there. The only jobs available, you can work the gas station if you can get one of the jobs. They've got 20 resumes sitting right there, people wanting to go work the third shift at the Casey's General Store. Or they're working in the grocery store. Or they might be, if they're lucky, they might be serving at the diner, if the town even still has one. No, the economic structure, the viability of rural America has been annihilated by Republicans who have embraced the corporate ag structure and basically do not really care to make sure that the quality of life in rural America is good. And sure, they always, well, why don't you want to move out here? Why don't you want to go out and bring your company out there? You might be able to. Some people do. But I've also talked about that as well, that they want you to come into town, but heaven forbid you're offering health care because the other companies in town that are still there, we're not offering health care. And, you know, we don't want you stealing our employees, so we'll shut you down before we let you come in here and offer paid family leave. What are you doing? A livable wage. Come on, man. I'm not Mr. Moneybags here. You need to pay what we're paying so no one leaves my job to go to your company. And if you don't like that, you can get out and go back to your metro area. Okay, fine. I'll go back. Why don't people want to move here? So the economic structure is not there to sustain these hospitals anymore. I'll also point out the amount of times Republicans have vilified doctors and nurses to where doctors and nurses, I know two nurses who are now in Minneapolis, St. Paul, who used to work in rural Minnesota, not the same town. Basically both left because the whole COVID thing just broke them. To sit there and try to save people's lives, and they're like, you're part of the liberal agenda. You know, you sit there and say, why don't we have hospitals and doctors? Why doesn't anyone work here? Well, have you tried being nice to them? No, not an option. Never forget. We'll never forget when COVID was going on, the South Dakota nurses, the ones that were over there talking about how they're saying, you need to say goodbye to your family and friends. You're dying. And they're like, this is a myth. And you're like, how is this even possible that these people could get brainwashed this bad? 5 feet higher on the Titanic. As I said earlier, 5 feet higher on the Titanic. Now, if I was a Republican and I represented a rural community and I saw that the local hospital was going to get rid of things, I would be calling in every favor I could at the state capitol to try to get a bill passed, to try to basically see if I could get some money out to these communities to help with hiring incentives, job incentives, military, medical initiatives, to help basically give the services that these people need. And you know what you don't see Republicans doing? Any of that. They talk about tax breaks. Well, if you're making $40,000 a year, getting an extra, even if you would get anything from a Republican tax break, which at $40,000 a year, that tax break is not for you. But even if you did, what, 10 bucks? That doesn't help you. Might cover the gas one way to the nearest medical facility that's going to be able to take care of you or your family. No, the only thing they care about is tax breaks for the wealthy, who don't even live in these communities anymore. And you wonder why there are swaths of this country right now where it's an hour, hour and a half to the nearest medical care, when it used to be 10 minutes down the road. And until we address this issue, namely get those damn Republicans out of these districts where they do not care about you, well, this is only going to get worse. And that the exodus from these rural communities will continue. It's the Matt McNeil Show. It is the Matt McNeil Show. By the way, we have 12 jurors. We have 12 jurors until the mob runs half of them off. Are you going to hold him in contempt of court? Are you? He's clearly in contempt of court. If Brett or I did anything like this, we would be in jail for 30 days. That would be for sure. 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. Hey, another Republican has announced they are leaving the House and headed home. Now, you say to yourself, okay, this must be another one of those in those toss-up states. Representative Jake LaTourneur, the Republican from Kansas, has declared his decision to not seek re-election in the fall in a public statement on Twitter that both acknowledged and downplayed criticisms that his party had spurred chaos in the House of Representatives. Undoubtedly, the current dysfunction in Capitol Hill is distressing, but it almost always has been. We just don't see most of it. Actually, the opposite is generally too, is true, is one of those things where it's once you get out of, away from Washington, D.C., you find out that when they're in closed doors, they're having, decent conversations. LaTourneur, 36, he said he left to pursue the opportunities unspecified with the exception of the charge to spend more time with his wife and four kids. Understand that. As I've got three kids, I remain optimistic about the future of this country, not only because we have overcome more significant obstacles in the past, but that vast majority of people I've served with are good and trying to do the right thing. He joins more than 20 House Republicans who this year have announced what they've had it with Congress. His announcement comes a day before Representative Mike Gallagher is due to leave after making a similar resignation announcement in March. I'll come back because I got a theory on this. I've got a theory on this exodus by the Republicans in a second. But let's go to Greg in Minnetonka. I want to chime in about rural town economics. Hey, Greg.
Hey, how you doing?
All right, man.
Okay, so I grew up in a small town in Minnesota, about 5,000 people, and in that town, if you were a farm kid, you were nothing. Your parents, if they were a business owner, a lawyer, a doctor, they could get away with murder.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I can give an example. Some of the stuff the cops would pick on you. One Sunday morning, I was going to church, And I was driving down Main Street, and I looked at my watch and went, oh, geez, I gotta get to church. I pulled into the bank parking lot, backed out. I got pulled over by the cop for driving the wrong direction in traffic. One Thursday night after church choir, I left there at, now, I was a senior, right? Going to church choir on Thursday night, getting out at 9 o'clock on a hill. I had to roll through a stop sign because Icy Roads, Minnesota, rear-wheel drive. I got pulled over by the cops for running a stop sign.
On an icy road. You know, it's Greg, what you're talking about is something that, you know, it's always been the way in small towns. If the wealthy people do things, they generally don't have any problem with it. You know, look at the dairy farm that has all those allegations against them. No one in the county attorney's offices wanted to touch those cases. But it's at the same time, it shouldn't surprise anyone that so many of these farmers that once their lifestyle left, they didn't even try to stick around. They just took off because, you know, what was there left for them in that town?
And even now, I mean, that was 50 years ago. But now, my brother, he went to a farm meeting, and at one of the local places where they, you know, they'll have a gathering and they try to sell Roundup and all kinds of other fertilizer and that kind of stuff. He left there, got 2 miles from town. The sheriff pulled him over. He said, "Where you been tonight?" My brother said, "You know where I was. You followed me out of the parking lot." He said, "Well, were you drinking?" He said, "No." He said, "Let's get the breathalyzer out."
Said,
Go ahead.
What town? Do me a favor. What town is this? I want to hear where this is.
I'll give you this much. It's Southwest Minnesota, but I'm not going to give you.
All right, good. Hey, Greg, thank you very much. I appreciate the sharing the information there. And you wonder why people don't want to go there, huh? Why don't people want to come here?
Especially medical professionals.
Have you thought about being nice to people? Yeah, have you thought in rural America? Have you thought about being nice to people? No? Try it. They might want to be around you. Anyway, let me get back to this story about now 20 House Republicans who have announced they've had it with Congress. They're not going to run again. This is more than just, I mean, I've talked about this in years. Some years you get, you know, 5 to 10. Makes sense. That's about average attrition. When we're now at 20, and my guess is we're going to end up probably somewhere around 23, 24, because there are still some people that are making up their mind here. And as the clown car brigade on the far right and the fart group, that's not going away. As long as they're still there, I think they're going to basically, vaporize, part of their Republican bloc as well. You know, try some Metamucil. Needless to say, I think there's something else going on here. Now that we're at this number, I'm starting to say to myself, okay, what is really going on here? And I think it's a combination of things. I think these Republicans are looking at, first of all, they've not been able to sway the pro-abortion vote back their way. I honestly thought when they got rid of Roe v. Wade that people would be celebrating in the streets, there'd be parades, all this, and now all of a sudden they're realizing, as Jeff Stein has said as well, they're the dog that caught the car and they have no idea what to do with it. And nothing that they keep putting out there seems to be working. And a lot of what they're trying to put with their new moderate Republican stance is being sabotaged by the far right, who basically don't care because they're in a district because they gerrymandered districts in 2010 that a turnip with an R next to its name could win. And so, and if that's the case, if the Republican was always going to win that district, the only option they have for diversity is more and more extreme Republicans. And so that's why in those districts, it's the, no, I'll murder 15 jurors for Donald Trump. That's how that guy gets into office. And so I think that the abortion issue is there. I think the money issue is something that talk about a failure of the media. The fact that the RNC now has been, basically overtaken, absorbed by the Trump campaign, that Senate races, U.S. Senate races, U.S. House races, governor's races that the Republicans need that money for, they're not going to get a dime of that. The fact that the Republican Party now is being asked to send tribute to Donald Trump, 5% of all your funds you're raising to Donald Trump. I think that they're realizing this, and I think that this is... They made their own mess when they made these districts, which they could not get, a Republican could not lose. And it's delicious to watch. And I think the real thing they're seeing is they are going to lose and lose badly. Chicago, have a good one. Minneapolis, St. Paul, hour two up next.
Hour number two of the show here on your Thursday. Good to have you with us, Matt and Brett, here today, the Matt McNeil Show. Representative Rick Hansen is the representative from 53B. He is also the chair for the Environmental and Natural Resource Finance and Policy Committee. He is kind enough today to join us about the big bill that got passed here on Monday to talk about the things that are in that and the good it's going to do. Representative, as always, good to talk to you again, and thank you very much for the time.
Great to be here.
And by the way, I know you're on the floor. If you do need to go, by all means, we completely understand. It's a busy day. So thank you very much for joining us. You sent me a video of you talking about something which is so no-brainer. It's not even funny, but it's lost on us. And that prevention costs a heck of a lot more than cleanup. And you use the reference to PFAS and the damage that they have done, and that 25, 30 years ago, people were talking about we should regulate these things, and it did not happen. And now we've got a mess on your hand. I think I can't tell you how glad I am that you're in charge of this committee, because it's common sense like this that I understand that people think that sometimes this is interfering with business. But the reality is it's saving the people a lot of money to regulate this on the front end as opposed to the back end.
And I actually think Minnesotans get it. You know, they believe in a polluter pays model. They don't believe in subsidizing profit by picking up, by having the public pick up the externalized costs of that production. I think it takes a while for elected folks to catch up, but you know they are, and we're doing a lot of good things. I mean, this bill on Monday just got passed or concurred with by the Senate, so it's on its way to the governor.
Nice.
The policy bill. That is following after the earliest in recent memory passing of the LCCMR bill, the recommendations for the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund. That's already become law. Policy bill, which is about 99 pages one of the provisions is the first of its kind upgrades of no longer calling rough fish, you know, that fish that were considered trash or junk and thrown on the banks by some of us when we were younger. They're now considered a valuable fish, and we upgraded the statutes for these native fish that are important. That passed, and it's on its way to the governor, providing modern licensing, electronic licensing, so you can get your hunting or fishing license on your phone rather than having to go into a store and fill out the form. So there's just a number of those things that are no-brainers. We're trying to take bill after bill, get them to the governor early instead of waiting for one big bill at the end.
You go in there, and this tells me you were doing it right, because there was a sausage making quality of this thing where I heard there were some Democrats that were a little bit bothered by the thing, some Republicans, but you did put out a bill that you tried to get a lot of input and take and put in things that the Republicans wanted in there as well. Correct.
That's correct. So the bill, the budget bill that includes policy, in recent memory, it's got more Republican provisions than one kind of unique one to talk about a Republican bill is we don't allow a sale of wild game. Like if I shot a deer, I can't sell you the venison. But there are things that for like bear fat that would be disposed of. There are people who have instead of throwing away bear fat, they're using it to make soap. Mm. And so it's something that would be discarded going into a landfill, and we provided an exception to the law so people could make soap out of bear fat. I mean, that was a Republican Nathan Nelson bill, and we included it. There were a couple of others. One was Republican bill to look at reopening the General Andrews Nursery, which was closed about 10 years ago. We had one state nursery. We used to have two. With the climate change and the need for trees, we are going to probably need full production from both of those nurseries, like we used to have, to provide trees for Minnesotans, for conservation, for urban areas, suburban areas and rural areas. And the bill that we were talking about has a significant investment in trees. You know, last year we had a record-setting investments in outdoor recreation and in climate change. But one piece where we felt we needed more was trees. And so this bill provides a lot of money for trees, about $15 to $16 million that would be both at state parks, but in cities and suburban areas, and prioritizing environmental justice communities, where often when trees come down, they may not go back up. Mm-hmm. So we want to make sure we have a diverse set of trees and of different ages in case we have another pest come by and into the next generation, like we do with emerald ash borer right now.
Well, and you, if we can talk a little bit about that, talk about what's in the bill about emerald ash borer, because I know you guys have, there have been these pests, and we talk about chronic wasting disease, which is in the deer population, these real dangers that are out there that have not been addressed. Talk about what are you guys doing to address the emerald ash borer, because obviously it's devastating a lot of the trees.
Well, I checked in my city alone, in the city of South St. Paul, the cost for the city for replacing the public trees that are damaged by emerald ash borer is $800,000. We had one of our colleagues, Representative Christy Purcell in Northfield, asked, and the cost in Northfield was over $2 million. And so trying to provide some assistance, we're going to need to provide more. We are a fraction of the investment that was made by the state of Minnesota when Dutch elm disease came through two and three generations ago. So this is a supplemental budget. It's not the budget year. And so investing in trees to try to start to catch up, not only on taking down, but also for replanting and trying to plan for the future. So that's a significant portion of the House bill. Is we're using the general fund. We have a target of about $10 million, and we're appropriating $8 million of that for trees, and then another a little over $1 million for lawns to legumes again, that we have about 25,000 Minnesotans that have signed up to convert their lawn from a traditional turf grass to pollinator habitat. And that benefits water quality and wildlife as well. A little small investment with technical expertise. Minnesotans all over the state are trying something different, and there's a huge backlog for that popular program. Mm-hmm. So getting programs to people. People love their trees. Next week is Arbor Week. Arbor Day is on April 26th in Minnesota. So these are some of the investments we think would be good in a supplemental budget, as well as the policy that we were talking about earlier. Representative Fu Lee has provisions that are looking at air quality, particularly in environmental justice areas, and then looking at PFAS. What is going to be the cost? What is the cost recovery we can do? Because the cleanup cost, particularly even for drinking water and wastewater, is going to be in the billions. And we don't want another PFAS on the horizon in addition to what we're dealing with now. Nitrates are there. We have provisions in there for nitrates and looking at salt. So there's just a variety of things that we have in this bill in addition to the money that would get out to people for trees and for converting their lawns.
You brought up the nitrate issue in rural Minnesota. This is something that's crippling these districts out there, where it's creating a massive healthcare crisis. The fertilizers getting into the water table and causing the nitrate issue. Also, pesticides are an issue there. Talk a little bit about that, because this is, as you talk about getting on the front end of a problem like this, we now see where the problem is. What are we able to do to not only treat the water supplies that have been contaminated with nitrates, but also try to limit the amount of more communities that are being hampered by this?
Well, we just passed in the Ag Committee, and it's really a revolutionary act, frankly. I give great credit to Chair Samantha Vang, yeah. Where we have a current program where 40 cents a ton fertilizer fee goes to production research. And what the Ag Committee, the DFL-led Ag Committee did is take that 40 cents, and instead of providing that for production research, providing that for drinking water assistance in that nine county area where high nitrates are impacting people's wells. We have a public health crisis there. Yes, we are going to be investing general fund dollars and clean water funds for practices that landowners can implement, but we have to deal with contaminated drinking water. And again, going back to the polluter pays model, you know, there is pollution that comes from nitrogen fertilizer. That's a fact. We've known that for a long time. I think I've mentioned to you before, 35 years ago when I worked at the Department of Ag, I worked on the Nitrogen Fertilizer Task Force that made recommendations to deal with nitrate pollution in groundwater. This is not a new issue. We've had enough task forces. We've had enough studies. We have to act, and I think that's why Minnesotans petitioned the EPA, and the EPA is saying we have to do something. And I really give credit to the Democratic members on the Ag Committee. Just think about that. The Ag Committee, with all the ag lobbyists sitting there in the room with their arms crossed, looking grumpy, passed that because said we need to do something different. That doesn't mean it's the only thing, but that's ongoing money that can go. So when there's also nitrate contamination around the state, not just in the Southeast, there's ongoing money that can help pay for that immediate drinking water protection, whether it be filters, whether it be bottled water immediately if we have to intervene, and also looking at how do we make those well supplies protected. We have spent hundreds of millions of dollars on voluntary practices. In my budget alone, in the environment, we authorized $21 million last year for cover crops. So those voluntary practices are not going to be enough. Mm-hmm. In addition, Chair Vang put in for additional enforcement relating to enforcing the nitrogen fertilizer rules. So a comprehensive approach. In the environment budget, we passed having the state look at its nitrogen fertilizer purchases. You know, what do we use in parks around the state? What do we use as nitrogen fertilizer? And then reducing that in 25%. So there's a comprehensive approach to try to deal with nitrogen. We did the same thing with salt. Road salt or salt on sidewalks is an issue. You can't manage what you can't measure. So we've directed the PCA to do tracking of how much salt do we buy as a state and reduce that amount by 25% so we can be tracking what we're using. If we're setting these goals for clean energy, if we're setting these goals for renewable energy, then we need to look at some of these contaminants and what do we do as the public entity. We can lead as the public entity, and then hopefully that provides a good example for the private sector to follow.
The environmental justice issue, one of the things I found to be interesting, the National Geographic had a very interesting story about inner core cities, namely Los Angeles, they were looking at, and how the planting of trees, not only obviously there's an aesthetic quality to it, better air quality with a tree, but it was keeping the heat down in areas, and that where there was heat crises in that city, that they, you know, it was areas where they didn't have a lot of trees. We are, once again, this is about being proactive. We are dealing with a warming planet here, and in a lot of urban areas, there just are not any trees. And you know, I think by addressing that, that's getting on the front edge of this, because the last thing we need is, you know, the incredible cost of heat, whether that's health wise or, you know, with energy bills, trying to keep things cool. By just putting out some trees, you can actually do a lot to cut those costs down, especially the healthcare costs as well.
Yep. And it helps on water storage. You know, it helps on carbon sequestration. The tree is better than that turf grass in storing carbon. You know, so what we can lead here, and hopefully the Senate will agree that we need to get these trees out there, and we need to come back again next year and the year after that. And that's why I think that we did invest in upgrading the existing nursery, and we need to look at the additional nursery. Plus, we are going to have to work with the nursery and landscape folks to get those trees out there. provide incentives for Minnesotans to be planting trees. What's the saying? The best day to plant a tree is today.
Yes.
And the next best day to plant a tree is tomorrow. So something like that. I can't remember it off the top of my head, but we've got to plant more trees, but we also have to look at prevention being better than cleanup. You know, when we plant the trees, when we handle these things, we've got to look at what we produce as human beings and how do we prevent some of these chemicals that we may have thought were okay. Maybe they were wonder chemicals. Maybe they stopped the bugs from eating the seeds. Maybe they, maybe it made the egg slide off your plate. All these things that were viewed as modern conveniences have a long time future consequence. And so we also need to be careful when we're looking at some of the solutions. So we have a definition of sustainable aviation fuel. We want to make sure that if there's going to be ramping up of production for ethanol for airplanes, that we're not cutting down trees and putting that land to the plow. Mm-hmm. So having these discussions in terms of policy is better than having to react 5 years from now and going, oh my gosh, the genie's out of the bottle and we don't know how to put it back in.
The bill passed 7258. It has a lot of things for Republicans in there. Does it still surprise you, though, the amount of people? I mean, I know, as you mentioned, the ag lobby, other industry lobbies, they are out there and they're out there basically pulling chains really tightly. But at the same time, I mean, I'm glad you're there and I'm glad the Democrats have the majority because things are getting done. But it does show us that there is no room for judgment here, that, you know, that this is a case where because of this Democratic leadership, things are actually getting done here.
And it takes leadership to break the ice, you know, because it's somewhat risky to venture out on that ice, if I want to maybe use a weird metaphor. But we've got to lead. And I think when you lead and when you actually get the vote there, particularly on this policy bill that we were talking about, 72 votes means that there were Republicans that voted for it. In the Senate today, I think there were 40 votes. So several Republicans voted for it. So I believe they are listening to their constituents when we see these bipartisan votes on environment. Last year on the environment investment bill, we had 3 Republican votes on that. I think that's more than most of the other omnibus bills at the time. I'm hopeful that at the end of the day, when we bring this budget and finance bill to the floor in both the House and the Senate, that there will be Republican votes. There were strong Republican votes for the LCCMR package. There were strong Republican votes for the environment policy bill on Monday and then concurring again today. And I think when you look at the whole, and it's in front of people for voting in the House and the Senate with that budget and investing in trees, I think it'd be a pretty hard vote to vote against getting trees out to Minnesotans.
Well, even if they do vote against it, they'll sure take credit for it. That's me saying it, not you. Representative Rick Hansen, District 53B, the chair of the Environmental Natural Resources Finance and Policy Committee. Representative, outstanding work, but this is what you do, man. You are fantastic, and thank God you are in there in a leadership position. I can't tell you how much I appreciate the time, and great job on this bill.
Thank you. It's a team effort. Earth Day is coming up, as is Arbor Day. Go plant a tree.
Go plant a tree. Pick up some trash. It's a fantastic. We always do that on Earth Day. Representative Rick Hansen, thank you very much. We'll take a break. Come on back. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on your Thursday. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show. 952-946-6205. Marla's saying she's lost 30 trees in her property to Emerald Ash Borer. And the thing that scares me a lot is what Sven Sundgaard said back when he used to come on the air here. And he said, we need to have a winter where we have consistent temperatures for like a week hitting, I think it said it was minus 17 in northern Minnesota. I don't think we got any close to that this year. And that kills that kills off the larvae. And so I'm expecting a massive die off of trees this next year. And at least, I mean, it's going to be bad. A few things here before we get, once again, Maggie Ferris is going to join us, comedian that's in town for shows on Friday, Saturday night. I'll get into that here in a little bit. But one, I do like to put these out when they come out. Four Minnesotans have been sickened by multi-state salmonella outbreak linked to a basil sold at Trader Joe's. I mean, it's pretty specific this time. It's not like all bag salad or something like this. It's if you bought basil at a Trader Joe's, throw it out immediately. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration is warning consumers not to eat the Infinite Herbs brand organic basil packaged in 2.5-ounce clamshell-style containers. According to the Minnesota Department of Health, four Minnesotans ranging from age of 3 to 59 have become ill between February 15th and March 27th. None of the Minnesotans sickened were hospitalized or died. In total, a dozen people have been infected in seven states in the outbreak. Trader Joe's has removed the product from their shelves, but anyone who has it in their refrigerator or freezer should just throw it away. Since the people with salmonella infection don't seek health care and get tested, MDH says the outbreak is likely to be larger than the identified cases. About 28% of people with laboratory confirmed cases required hospitalizations. Symptoms include diarrhea, abdominal pain, and fever. So obviously, some things there. So once again, if you bought basil at Trader Joe's, chuck it. I think that's about the best way to say it. Because you don't want to be sick. Going back to my discussion about rural healthcare and things are closing. It's interesting. I've already had a few conservatives say, the problem is in things you said, Matt. The problem is these government healthcare programs are bankrupting the system. Okay, so if your argument is right, then the first hospitals that should be closing are the ones where there's a lot of people, far more people on medical assistance. And no, the metro area where you have a larger percentage of people of lower income than you have out in rural areas, although you still have them out there, God forbid the Republican Party actually acknowledge the majority of people out there actually need government assistance to survive in rural Minnesota. But no, if your argument was the case, then we'd be seeing all the major metro hospitals. We can't make it here. No, if anything, the one thing that's going to keep these going, hospitals going in rural parts of the state is government assistance, help from the state. And you see, that's the deal is you're the ones come to us and say, Why can't you help us? Why aren't you helping us? I want to help you, but you have to identify the problem first. And the problem is your system is failing because Republican policies have basically almost guaranteed the medical system in rural parts of the state is going to go down. Is Jeff in St. Paul on the line?
Oh, no, we do not have it.
Okay. Okay. Well, no, call back at another time. I got to take a break. When we do come on back, Maggie Ferris is going to join us. She is in town doing some shows on Friday and Saturday over in St. Paul at the Laugh Camp Comedy Club. We'll talk to her about that. It's coming up. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on your Thursday. I'm public. There's a place that I go. There's a space in my heart when it all comes crashing down. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show. Our next guest has been named one of the funniest lesbians in America by Curve Magazine, won the Advocate Magazine's national search for the next funny queer comedian. She is going to be performing over at Laugh Camp Comedy Club tomorrow and on Saturday. Tomorrow night, 8 p.m. Saturday at 7 p.m. Maggie Ferris is kind enough to take some time to talk about comedy and do these shows. Hi, Maggie. How are you?
Hi, I'm well. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. Congratulations on the shows here. And you've been performing here locally for many, many years.
Many, many, many years. I started in 99.
Now I'm feeling old. Well, now I mean, I was born in 68. So, I mean, but you still, man, it's feeling old. Where are you from originally?
I'm from the Twin Cities.
Oh, which suburb?
Well, you know what? I started in Minneapolis and then when I was 11, moved to St. Paul.
Oh, you are both sides.
Yeah, I'm a city kid, and I can't pick a side. I got both feet on each side of the river.
Well, that's the nice thing about the Twin Cities is generally most people here don't really. Like even the most diehard Minneapolis person, a diehard St. Paul person, they go to the other side and go, oh, this is nice. You know, this is okay.
Yeah. I know so many that still won't even cross the river. They're like, oh, I'm not going to Minneapolis. Oh, I'm not going to St. Paul.
And then they get dragged over there for like a wild game. And it's like, oh, okay, yeah, it's okay over here.
Yeah, it's not bad. Come on. It's not bad. It's pretty much the same.
Get over yourself, for goodness sakes. The show is coming up here at the Laugh Camp Comedy Club. It's nice. Once again, I want to make sure I mention this, and I'll put the link out for everyone here. It's going to be 8 p.m. Friday, 7 p.m. on Saturday. Talk a little bit about your show, because I want to talk about this. And also, you got a podcast out there that you do as well. So you obviously, you can't be doing as much stuff as you're doing without coming up with a lot of new material consistently.
I always am writing new stuff. There's some comics out there that just write an hour and they do that same hour forever and ever and ever. But I have 3 full length comedy albums out and I'm working on a 4th. And so wow. I'd say another 5-6 months, I'll have that one done. And I just like to write jokes. I love coming up with jokes and tags for jokes and making the joke better and better and better and better until it's beautiful and nice and polished and fun. And then we put it out on an album and we start writing new stuff.
Bless you for doing comedy albums, because as a kid who did grow up in the 70s, comedy albums are so important. And frankly, I've got a ton of them myself. It is, I always find it, it's so nice. And I get it with the modern day, and that when the cable television started and stuff, they started doing clips. But I always, it's so much nicer that if I'm like on a road trip or doing something like this, I can put in a comedy album and get the entire show. I always love that.
Yeah, I do too. And I love kind of weaving it into like one long narrative, you know, like you have all these tiny chunks that you get to put together in one long story. And for me, that's really fun. It's hard to do, you know, to make it all fit, to make it all work, because I never write with that narrative in mind. I just write what's funny and what I think is interesting and going on right now, you know?
You have been doing this long enough to where, you know, we started, and when we started this, and when you're talking about, you know, LGBTQ comedians, LGBTQ singers, LGBTQ, performers, that the idea was, it probably started off as comedy for the LGBTQ population. But now we, at least in the last few years, it seems we're finally getting over that hump, and it's becoming much more about, it's just a great comedian who just happens to have a different perspective. And I mean, are you seeing that? Because it does seem like that's what's happening in not only comedy, but music and stuff, is that it's no longer a separate subsect. It's just basically part of the original plan now.
Yeah, and definitely, like, I feel like it's more accepting of diversity than it has ever been before. I mean, when I started, it was just a white man's game, you know, a straight white man's game. And you would try to get booked somewhere and they'd be like, well, we already had a woman this year, you know, things like that. And so there's a lot of comics out there that would just say, I'm a gay comedian. You know, I play gay cruises and gay rooms and stuff like that. But for me, I want to just be a comedian who happens to be gay, because I really love the challenge of trying to make everyone laugh and everyone enjoy the show. I think everyone works really hard all week and they want to come out and relax and enjoy. And so there's not a lot of pressure about gay stuff. And, you know, I'll try to educate a tiny nugget here and there, but it's going to be funny and you're going to have a good time hearing it and you're not even going to know. So
it's got to be pretty good to walk in, if you're gay, to walk into a room full of people who are heterosexual and be able to get laughs out of that, because it shows you that the comedy is elevated. It's not something that's unique and that the audience understands and gets it. I got to believe that, you know, putting it from an individual perspective, and still being able to relate, I that's got to be just gold.
Yeah, and it's a challenge that I love, you know. I absolutely love that. And it's so funny, cuz sometimes I will play specifically like a gay show or something like that, and sometimes it's harder, you know, cuz my writing isn't geared towards that, you know. I mean, I throw lots of stuff in there, but sometimes they are more sensitive, and it's a very different crowd. So it's a challenge both ways, but I enjoy just being a comedian, you know, and I happen to be gay too. So
have you ever been stuck at, like, I mean, I'm trying to think of like the most white heterosexual situation can be in, which I think a lot of times is going to be in denial, but like a tractor convention in Fargo. Have you ever had a really show?
I feel like the whitest heterosexual show I ever did was in Chicago, in like, it was like Zany's downtown, and it was all frat boys, and they just wanted to hear, you know, like, yeah, straight white men jokes, and they just, they didn't have time for me, but I just stood up there, did my time, took my check, and went home. You know what I mean?
Beautiful. Beautiful. Yeah. You know, but that's comedy. Sometimes you get great crowds. I've talked to a lot of comedians who will go out some small towns, do a small event, and it's an amazing crowd. But then you do Chicago, and it's like, oh, good. Delta Chi is here. Great.
Yeah. I thought it was unbelievable. That was the entire audience. I was like, what? There's no women. There's no minorities. Nothing. It's just all young white dudes.
We are in a political environment where you have people fighting out there on pronouns and stuff like this. Let's talk about this. How do you approach this with your audiences?
Well, like when I even start out, I think my first joke is, hi, I'm Maggie Ferris. My pronouns are she, her, but my adjectives are adorable and sturdy. Like, I think we should use more parts of speech, you know? And then I'll say, my wife said, you are sturdy. And I say, oh, I'm probably gay. And I say, probably, because I went to the doctor last week and he had the cutest butt I've ever seen. And so now I'm questioning everything. Mm-hmm. And then I say, you know what? My adverbs are nappy and snacky. It's just a vicious cycle in my house. I go home. I have a snack. I got to take a little snooze. I wake up. I say, time for yum yum. Just go over and over and over and over again.
It would be a better world if we did have a little bit, we did flush this out a little bit more for most of us.
Yeah, it's just fun and silly, you know?
You not only are doing stand-up comedy, but you've delved into the podcast world, and congratulations on being one of the few people that actually figured it out, because you have got one of the top 100 comedy podcasts on Apple. Your fellow comedian, Julie Bain, Big Labia Energy is the name of the podcast, correct?
Yes, that is correct.
So
we just started this year. We're just halfway through the first season, but it's kind of taken off and it's been really fun.
Talk about the development of that. What was the way you approached it?
Well, I really wanted to do something with her. And I mean, we work together a ton and we write together. I did a sketch series called, can I say D-Y-K-E? You know, it's a do-it-yourself sketch series, but the first word is that. We wrote that together, and she's just an amazing writer and very funny. And I was like, how do we harness this and get laughs? So we poke a lot of fun at each other. We talk a lot of issues, and we have a good time. And so it's kind of taking off, and it's just been really fun. And I can't wait to just keep going and going and going with it.
No, it is nice, because I think you can do with a podcast, and it doesn't, you know, from whatever the background of any individual is, you know, a comedian or an actor or this. But if you have relatable stories, that's what elevates it. I mean, that's what, you know, if I don't care who I'm listening to, if they have something about, say, like a, you know, DoorDash or, you know, current political issues that I can relate to, it makes it endearing. And like I said, it kind of breaks down barriers far more than creating them by just having people, the relatability of all this.
For sure. And I feel like when you're listening to a podcast, you're kind of listening to an intimate conversation between friends. And it's you know, just that talk and that witty banter back and forth, it just is engaging, you know, and fun to listen to.
Absolutely. Going back to the albums that
you'll be at Laugh Camp too, just by the way.
Oh, is she going to be doing this
for me?
Oh, she opened up. Okay, so that's the opening act is Julie Bain, and of course Maggie's going to be there as well. Maggie Ferris is joining us right now. You one of your albums here is a relaxation album. Talk about that.
Yeah, that's not including my comedy albums. That's just a thing I did aside when I was bored during COVID. So you know how you listen to those silly like guided meditations and stuff? I just wanted to write one that was just totally weird. And so I did. And it's just strange and silly and fun and probably not really that relaxing, but it's in that relaxing voice and take the deep breaths and slow down your brain. And, you know, I just say weird stuff, you know, like put your croissant down. I don't even remember what is all on it, but it's just silliness and fun and something I had to do during the pandemic. Cause it's like, you got all this creative stuff and you have nowhere to go. We used to do these Zoom comedy shows and they were so awful. Cause you have no feedback. Yeah. You either have the whole mic, everybody's mics are on and they're like, honey, get me a sandwich. And you can hear everything. Or nobody's mics are on. You have no idea how they're responding and if they're enjoying it or anything. You know, people just sit there and stare. And so that was so hard during the pandemic to not do live shows. But I had to keep the creative juices flowing. So that's what I did. I wrote a relaxation album.
Extreme Relaxation is the name of that album. You just touched on there because I'm wearing a Dury shirt right now, the band Dury out of Burnsville. And I've talked to Austin a few times. And the same exact thing. All of a sudden, you're used to doing shows and you're not doing anything. And so he starts doing TikTok videos with his sister, ends up being the biggest band he's ever been in. And, you know,
isn't
it's kind of
crazy?
Robert Burrell, the comedian in town, he talked about the same thing as how hard it was because comedian minds just work differently than everyone else's. And you always are looking at writing new comedy and stuff like this. And you want that outlet. And a FaceTime is not going to cut it.
No, it was just so hard and such a different time. And I can't not be creative and think of things and have ideas and try fun stuff. So for me, that's how it came out during the pandemic is the Extreme Relaxation album.
All right. So go to the iTunes on Apple, get the podcast, Big Labia Energy with Maggie and Julie Bain. That's there. Once again, one of the top 100 comedy podcasts on Apple right now. So they're hitting. That's huge. The comedy albums, which, by the way, God bless you. And every comedian out there put out comedy albums because they are a godsend and a bit of a throwback for me. Because like I said, nothing funnier than Monty Python or Bob Newhart when they used to do theirs. Oh, Steve Martin's old ones are fantastic. Oh, yeah. Love them. So keep
Richard
doing those.
Pryor, I remember listening to
those. Oh, yeah.
Too.
Oh, God. Those were ones I didn't listen to with my mom and dad around that.
No. In your bedroom with the door closed.
Indeed. Maggie Ferris is at Laugh Camp Comedy Club. Once again, this is on Robert Street North in St. Paul. It's tomorrow night, 8 p.m., Saturday night, 7 p.m., with Julie Bain and Max Chapman as well going to join you on those. I've got the Eventbrite link. I'll put that out on all the social media pages. Maggie, awesome. Anytime you want to, by all means, please come on back.
Love it. Thank you so much for having me on. I appreciate it.
My absolute pleasure. Maggie Ferris, once again, the Laugh Camp Comedy Club tomorrow and Friday, or tomorrow and Saturday. Tomorrow is Friday and then Saturday. Go catch the shows. We'll take a break. Come on back. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on your Thursday. I want to take a ride on your disco stick. Let's have some fun. This beat is sick. Because we can. Yes, we can. AM950, the progressive voice of Minnesota, the Matt McNeil Show. Well, I guess I got it. I mean, I tried to basically use up the entire hour with interviews, but I guess I got to talk about a story. And thank God I haven't talked about the Anoka Hennepin County School District in a while. Son of a. Here we go. You guys keep forgetting when you elect the loon balls to the school board that basically bad things happen. Now, I guess it's an improvement that you don't have at the Anoka Hennepin County School District a bunch of the LGBTQ kids killing themselves like you did a few years ago. But it still is not good. The Anoka Hennepin County School Board member, backed by a conservative parents' rights group, says he plans to force a budget shutdown if the district does not scrap programs aimed at racial and gender equity. Now, I want you to stop there. Racial and gender equity. That doesn't favor anybody. That basically says we want everyone on the same playing field. Because as a matter of fact, it's very Christian, if you can. As a person who is a Christian, it's a very Christian, the equity, inclusion, diversity stuff, the stuff is, for me, that is the stuff that is what Jesus wanted us to do. Equality, diversity, inclusion. That's Christianity. And so if you're against those things, Christian. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, you should read them. They're a hoot. Anyway, that's me. You know, my religious disclaimer. You do or don't do whatever it is you do or don't want to do. I'm a Christian. Now, that being said, this isn't about trying to help one group over another group. This is basically trying to equal the playing field.
Matt Audette wrote on an April 12th Facebook post that he would not vote for any bill that included the spreading of divisive and one-sided views. I'm presuming that what he's talking about is the people who are like, I'm a white racist supremacist. Hey, stop talking about equality. I'm building my entire life on the idea of white power. I'm presuming that's what the people that are upset about this are. I don't know. I'm not saying anything about Mr. Audette, but why would you be upset about equality? Why would you be upset about this? Why? Why would you be upset about this? And so my guess is Audette's trying to preserve that kind of view. I don't know. Maybe he could clarify a little bit. Officials in the North Metro School District say many of these programs are required by law, and eliminating them would imperil the district's funding and students' ability to graduate. Heaven forbid we actually do that. Audette won re-election in 2021 with the support of the 1776 Project PAC, which opposes diversity, equity, and inclusion in public schools. He said that he and school board members Zach Arco and Linda Hochman, who both had won election last fall with the backing of the Conservative Minnesota Parents Alliance, had developed a list of items they would not fund. Minnesota school board candidates supported by parents' rights groups lost most of their races over the last several years. But since the Anoka-Hennepin School Board has six members, this block of three now comprises half the board. Audette's lengthy list of targets includes any use of concepts of equity and anti-racism. Oh, you can't make it up. You can't. Wait a minute. You want to stop racism? Wait a second. We can't allow that. What are you doing, man? This is from Sahan Journal. Targets any inclusive concepts of equity or anti-racism with the staff or students, culturally responsible teaching, land acknowledgments, social emotional learning, several staff positions focused on diversity, equity, and inclusion, adoption of Minnesota's new social study standards, requiring or asking students to share their gender or pronouns, restorative justice practices, any display of flag other than the American flag. This is Trump flag. Is Trump flag okay with you? I'm going to guess it is. Audette wrote, it is our sincere hope that the board administration can come together to make the necessary updates to our system to stop doing these things so we can avoid budget standoff, which would potentially come ahead July 1st if we're unable to approve the budget. Sahan Journal requested interviews with all six Anoka-Hennepin County School Board members, but none replied. School board co-chairs Arco and Casey Deshean released a joint statement Wednesday afternoon saying no decision has been made yet on the budget and the issues raised by Audette. The school board is committed to shared leadership model that ensures all voices on the board are heard as part of the decision-making process, Arco and Deshean said. They said Audette's concerns were discussed at a work session April 4th, would again be on the agenda April 23rd. Jim Skelly, the district's communication director, provided an 11-page document which he said the board discussed April 4th meeting, citing more than 30 state and federal laws that require the district to include some of the programs Audette objects to. They included the U.S. Constitution and a 2021 settlement agreement with the Minnesota Department of Human Rights, resulting from a lawsuit filed by a transgender student in the Anoka-Hennepin County School District. For goodness sakes, you have to by law because of the failures of the school district already. And you're saying no? I mean, if I'm a parent in that school district, just get your lawyers on speed dial. Seriously, just get your lawyers on speed dial. Let's not get to the point we were the last time we started having problems with Anoka-Hennepin, where basically kids were committing suicide because of encouraged bullying in the school district. So can we all in the Anoka-Hennepin County School District get your lawyers on speed dial? Because that fear that they might get sued might be enough for them to say, well, fine, I guess we'll do it the way the law says we have to. One of the items Audette said he would not fund is the state's new social studies standards. In January, a judge approved the new standards, which will form the basis of social studies instruction for every school district in the state. The new revision adds ethnic studies to state social studies standards for the first time, which advocates say will make Minnesota's social study classes more inclusive and representative for the state's diverse of communities, though the standards will not go into effect until fall of 2026. Guidance from the Minnesota Department of Education indicates that districts should engage in professional development and curriculum selection over the next 2 years. We cannot adopt a curriculum that is obviously slanted or biased towards a single worldview that is decidedly negative of what it teaches about our country, Audette Road, because heaven forbid you, I don't know, talk about what happened to the Native Americans in a negative way, or what happened to the Black people in a negative way, or what happened to the LGBTQI population in a negative way. Like I said, I don't know who this guy is trying to appeal to. I think the we got a little bit of a sneak peek, though, when he says his lengthy list of targets includes any of the use of the concepts of equity or anti-racism. So I don't know. Maybe he's trying to appeal. Maybe he's trying to appeal to the white racist crew. But Anoka Hennepin, I get it. You guys lean a little bit more conservative up there. But when your school taxpayer dollars are being paid out to kids who are filing civil lawsuits against your district for as bad as they've been treated by the district, because that's what happened last time. The school district had to do a big payoff, and all of a sudden, all those far right-wing school board members said, well, I proved my point, now I'm going to run away, because they didn't want to have to deal with the consequences of their actions. But here we are a few years later, and we're back to this. Now, it will be interesting how you think you can, from the mighty pillar of democracy, the seat of the school board in the Anoka Hennepin County District, how you think you're going to dictate federal policy from that position. As Lord knows, I mean, that makes the constitutional sheriff's movement look like they're actually of legitimacy. But good luck with all that. Good luck with all that. And once again, parents in the Anoka Hennepin County School District, get those lawyers on the speed dial, because I have a feeling you might be able to make a few dollars. Native Roots Radio is up next. We'll have a good one. We're back tomorrow. Till then, see ya.